Hello, welcome to Football Journeys. We're on Zoom again for this episode. We couldn't persuade our guests to come down from Lincoln to our studios in Wembley today, but given that it's Lincoln, Nebraska, it's probably fair enough. John McGuigan is more Merseyside than stateside, but he's in the US in a senior role with sports analysis giant Huddle. Probably every academy footballer in the country is obsessed with Huddle video footage, and quite often it finds its way onto Instagram highlights reels. Not that the clubs that we work with like that. John and the Huddle team were responsible for so much of how training, drills and all the other clever things in football are dealt with. His background's in coaching and analysis, which took him across the EFL, then his big break at Manchester City, eventually moving on to his beloved Liverpool via a World Cup with Ghana, of course. And now John finds himself at Huddle in Lincoln, Nebraska. John, welcome to Football Journeys.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Matt. It's nice to finally do this.
We always start at the beginning and you found yourself in analysis within football, like all of us. I think you were slightly more talented than me, football-wise. You were just a kid who loved football, wanted to be playing for one of the big clubs on Merseyside. And I think you were a bit of a split family. When you were a Red, and half the family were Blues, you wanted to be a Red.
Yeah, my dad and my brother are both big Blues. My brother goes home and away watching Everton for his sins. And my mum's side, my granddad on that side, got hold of me and took me to Anfield a couple of times. And I think once you've been to the stadium and stuff, whatever team you support, you just kind of get the bug, don't you? And you can't switch after that.
Yeah, unless you're Jamie Carragher, of course, but that's another story. I know you're going to be humble because you always are on this stuff, but no, you were a talented footballer, and I think you would have had some aspirations and hopes early on. I think you played a bit of sort of schools football, had some trials here and then, but you probably weren't quite the level you were going to get into an elite academy.
Oh yeah, I mean, I was definitely never going to be good enough for academy football. You know, I loved playing, obsessed with playing, just like, you know, most lads in the area my age. Played for the school, like you say, you know, we had a decent school team and decent Sunday league team and stuff, but I knew that I wasn't going to be good enough to play academy football. And I think that was how I ended up kind of looking towards more coaching. You know, I started like volunteer coaching when I was like 14, volunteered as a referee when I was around that age as well, because I knew I wanted to do something in the game. I just didn't know exactly what it was at the time. But I think when you look around and, you know, the way lads at our school who had trials at Everton, Liverpool, I knew I wasn't at their level, but I did feel like I understood the game. I feel like I was always the person who was telling people where to be or what to do. I probably just couldn't quite do it myself. So I guess that's why it was natural. I ended up in kind of like coaching and stuff after that.
And this is a funny thing to say. I'm a huge football fan. I adore the game. I feel as though I know a decent amount about it. I'm one of those blokes that doesn't like watching football in the pub because I hate the idiots who don't know what they're talking about. But all of that said, the one thing, I'm going to say the one thing, it's quite a big thing. The analytics of it, the coaching of it, it's a massive blind spot for me. When I was a young lad, I felt as I kind of understood the way the games were going, the way it was flowing, but I couldn't set up a team the way they would play. I couldn't set up a back line to do this, that, the other. When I played Football Manager as a young kid, I just wanted to get on and find some players to sign and then press play. Whereas I guess you would have been one of those people who have been, you know, kind of, should you have an overlapping fullback at this point, and et cetera. So is that something you got from a really early age? You wanted to do those tactics, those set plays and all those other things?
Yeah, I think that's interesting, Matt, because obviously the story of Will Still is in the media at the moment, and him being obsessed with Championship Manager, Football Manager, and obviously he's coaching now the highest level. I think when I was that type of age, I was the same. You know, we had like an old school PC. I think my dad bought us it for Christmas in like 1995, maybe, I think it was. And I remember having like the Football Manager, like Championship Manager, like CD-ROM that you put in. And I would sit there for hours, you know, playing on that. So not too dissimilar to a lot of people like at that time, I don't think. But I think when I realized that it could be more a career, and I found that, you know, there were university degrees starting to pop up, you know, in the area of coaching science, There were a couple of analysis degrees that were starting to pop up at the time. You know, I remember going to speak to like a careers advisor and stuff and talking about wanting to be, you know, a football analyst or a football coach. And at the time, they didn't really know what that was. You know, this was like 2003, 4, 5. I think probably I was on Football Manager and all those types of things. But then when I realized that it could be a career, there could be something there, I think that really sort of poured petrol on the fire, really. And I probably became a bit more obsessed with it, if you like.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a little bit of an opportunity here. I mean, we've got our sponsor, UCFB, and obviously we'd usually be in the studio with them recording this right now. But it was University of Central Lancashire that you went to. And those things were just developing. Obviously, now there's a whole suite of degrees that are on offer from places like UCFB and others. Talk to us about that. And I'm very conscious that there will be a lot of young lads and lasses listening to this who they picked up on this episode because they're thinking, yeah, I fancy a bit of that. I'd quite like to do a career trajectory that goes like John's. So talk to us a little bit about your degree and kind of what you were aiming to get out of it then. And how that's transpired now.
Yeah, I think the first thing is that back then, really the main courses in sport were kind of like sports science, more like strength and conditioning, sports science. So you had the big universities like Loughborough, John Moores, obviously Liverpool, John Moores. So I think there were a lot more people going to uni for that sort of thing, but there weren't really many degrees in the coaching side. Coaching pedagogy, coaching science. There definitely weren't any courses just in analysis at the time. So I ended up at Central Lancashire. It was a sports coaching degree. I think it was only the second cohort that they'd had. I think it had just literally started. I ended up going to uni and doing that. There was definitely a big range on the course. There were people basically, I don't want it to come across the wrong way, but I don't think they had an interest in sports careers. I think they just knew they wanted to go to uni, probably for the social side, and just pick the course they thought would be easy. So you had like those people. And then you also had people who had maybe been ex-academy footballers who hadn't made it and had been, you know, offered funding to go to uni. So you had this big like range really on my course. And I think I was one of the more serious people on it. Obviously, I had a good time because it was university, but you know, really threw myself into the studying aspect of it, but also the internship part of it. And I think internships now are a big part of uni degrees with people like UCFB. But at the time, they were pretty unheard of, really. I think some of the sports science people at John Moores were going to Everton at the time on like an internship thing in their third year. But on the coaching side, like I say, it didn't really exist. So the internship part of my degree was really big for me. I probably learned more in the first couple of weeks on my internship than I did on the course, which is no disrespect to the people on the course, but just teaching the course. But it was just, you know, being in my first academy environment, working with professional coaches. Obviously, I'd never been an academy player, so you very quickly learn about that environment. So I think the internship thing at the time wasn't as big as it is now. And I think for anybody who's watching this, when they pick a course or decide to go to somewhere like UCFB, you need to make sure that practical element is built in, because yes, the academic side is very important, but the practical and work experience side is probably what will get you an opportunity, you know, when you graduate, is how I describe it.
It's interesting. I'm sat here and I did a law degree, ended up becoming a lawyer, went to a law firm, and everything you say just resonates with the way that my experience went. There are a lot of people at my uni that were there to, well, I think it'd be unfair to say it was a 3-year IB for holiday, but there were some people that it wasn't that far off. And I think it's a really unfair thing for us as the grown-ups to say to 18-year-old lads and lasses, to say to them, you've got to have a bit of a plan. You've got to go there with, why are you doing this degree? But I did kind of, I wouldn't say that I was laser beam focused in when I was doing my law degree. I went there because it was a good degree to do. I thought I might end up becoming a lawyer, and actually a few things fell into place. But there were some people that just thought, why are you here? There's absolutely no reason for you to be here. And then you use those two elements of those people that are there just for a bit of a piss up, and then lads that have just dropped out of academy football, and it's that kind of shrug of shoulders and, well, someone's funded me to be here, so I may as well go and do it. And it is, it's a tough thing to say to young people, go and have a plan. But the one thing that is absolutely bang on is you've got to go out and get work experience. You won't end up at a top law firm unless you've shown them, I went there, I went there, I went there. That's because I want to do this, I want to do this, and I want to do that. And I guess that is the kind of the point, whether it's law, sport, football, whatever else, that is the kind of point, which then brings us to those internships. So, right, let me get this right. Blackpool, is that, that was the first one?
Yeah, it was, yeah. Matt, by the way, I should give full disclosure here because I don't want anyone calling me out that used to teach me at uni. I didn't get a first in my degree by any means. I actually got a 2-2. And it's something that at the time I was kind of embarrassed about and ashamed about, that I didn't get a 2-1, which was kind of obviously the standard that was expected. And, you know, now I'm, you know, probably old enough and ugly enough to kind of talk about it and say, look, I had a great time at uni. I definitely took my eye off the ball on the assignments part. I'm not particularly gifted academically. I didn't enjoy the assignments part. And I didn't put the work in on that side of it, and therefore I got a 2-2. But what I did do was, I think I was one of only two or three people on the course who got an internship at the time, and I really threw myself into that side of it. So I guess it's that balance of, you know, the practical versus the academic side. I think I did take my time at uni seriously, despite having a good time, but I got a 2-2. And like you say, at Blackpool, that was where I really, you know, probably learned probably as much as I have in my career in that early stage.
And that Blackpool, so what we're looking at, 2006, 2007, and this is the one that I should have noted down. Is that during the period when Blackpool have had a little period in the Premier League and then the Championship? I'm trying to remember exactly where they'd have been at that time.
I think they were in League One at the time. So Simon Grayson was the manager. Obviously, he ended up going up the leagues with other clubs. So it was the League One year, and then they got promoted into the Championship. They got to the playoff final at Wembley and ended up in the Championship. And obviously that was then the start, really, of them ended up in the Premier League. So it was an interesting time to be there. I mean, it was the whole industry was different then. So, you know, it was very much a case of like filming training sessions, filming the under 18 games, filming the first team games, and basically taking that video back to the university analysis suite and like coding the games and clipping up the games.
And I'm going to ask an ignorant question. What does that mean, coding the games?
Yeah, so coding the games is, I mean, there's obviously Huddle have a product that you can do that with called SportsCode. That's probably the most widely used one. There's other companies' software that does a very similar thing. But basically you review the game, you have like a tagging window, a code window with different buttons, and you can name the buttons whatever you like. So it might be really simple stuff like shots or, you know, set pieces, but really what proper analysts do is they build buttons that have links to the tactical elements of the game, whether it be playing style or game plan. So it's buttons about things around, say, first phase build up, and then the aspects that the coach wants to see during those build up moments. So that's really what coding is in a, you know, very basic explanation. And that's what we were doing, really. You know, like I say, we were just filming sessions because it had never been done before, and we were clipping those videos up and then feeding it back to the coaches. Back at the training ground when we went back later that week. But like I say, being in that environment and, you know, having an analyst at that level wasn't really a thing at the time. So I think the coaches were really receptive to it as well, which is a big thing, really, when you're in your first internship, to work with coaches who are actually interested in what you can offer when you're just a young kid at uni. You know, I'll always be, I mean, Simon Grayson probably doesn't even remember who I am, I'm sure. And Gary Parkinson, who unfortunately has had some health issues since then, but just really great people, you know, been in the game a long time, but very open to what we could do and what we could offer.
And there have been a lot of, I mean, with young analysts, it quite often is the case, a lot of hard yards in that as well. A lot of thankless time spent, you know, clipping, going through games, and then a hell of a lot of the work that you end up doing doesn't end up getting used at all. So it takes a lot of resilience to do that.
Yeah, I think me and Aaron Briggs, who I did the internship with, he's now at Wolfsburg in Germany, and he's been at Monaco since then, and we were both at Man City together, ironically. So, Aaron has now ended up in Monaco and Wolfsburg, you know, the highest level of the game, still involved in analysis. You know, and when we WhatsApp each other every now and again, you know, we say it's a long way from Blackpool, because at the time, obviously, Blackpool League One, I think the training ground was basically an oldish building with some porter cabins added on. And we would spend hours just traveling there because we didn't have a car. So we were getting on the train. The train station was right at the back of the training ground at the time, Squires Gate. And I'm smiling because although it was really like long hours, you were trying to balance the studying and partying as well with that. Those were some of the best times, you know, just the buzz really of being inside a real football club and working with, you know, coaches who've been in the game a long time, getting to watch as many training sessions as you wanted, you know, having access to those types of people when you're still studying was, you know, just a really cool experience. And obviously, it led on to bigger and better things. But at the time, it felt like, you know, what an amazing first step this is. You know, it was definitely an experience that, like I say, I smile whenever I talk about it now.
You've then got on your CV a time with the FA, but it seems to overlap with the degree. So was that part of the internship process, part of the plan?
Yeah, I think as I was getting to, I think I was going into my final year, and I was thinking about what I was going to do afterwards. I was trying to get ahead of it, basically, to try and make sure I had a job when I finished uni. So I started to basically email, blanket email, like every club in the country, about the fact that, you know, I was still studying, but I'd done a bit of work at Blackpool. A couple of people at Blackpool had helped me out as well with contacts in different places. And obviously I didn't get a response to almost all those emails, but there were a few people who did reply. Again, they probably wouldn't even remember who I am, but, you know, Mike Dickinson at Everton at the time replied to me. Michael Edwards, who was at Portsmouth at the time, was obviously sporting director of Liverpool until very recently. He replied to me with some great pointers. And Steve O'Brien, who was at the FA, he's still at the FA now working with the England teams. He headed up like the video analysis department, as it was at the time. And he came back to me and said, you know, let's stay in touch. And then a couple of weeks later, the phone went and somebody had dropped out of a women's national team camp in Yorkshire. And Steve basically said, I need somebody to go and, you know, clip up some of the stuff from this camp, basically. It's going to be sink or swim, but do you fancy it? And I said, yes. And I think the next day I was at his house picking up an England tracksuit and some equipment. And then I just went and swam just about, I think. So I ended up doing 3 years or so with the FA. I think I graduated and then I stayed with the FA for a little bit doing their training camps and going to tournaments with the youth teams, the women's teams, even the disability teams, which I know you had Dave Clark on the podcast not long ago. That was a really eye-opening experience in terms of the challenges that those athletes face and having to adapt as a practitioner to work with those athletes. Learned a lot from working with the cerebral palsy England team. That was, again, one of the best experiences I've ever had professionally, I think, despite it being early. So the England experience was really cool, yeah.
Well, I was going to jump on that because one thing you won't know, we're recording this, having just recorded the episode that's going to precede yours. That's with a lad called Jack Rutter, who was, so you may well know Jack, I don't even know whether you would have worked with him at the time, but obviously played for the cerebral palsy team, captained them because he had a neurological brain injury as a result of being assaulted that night.
Yeah, Jack came just after me, I think. I think Mike Barker was probably I think he might have been the captain at the time of the group. And Matt Dimbers was also one of the more experienced players. I think we went to Australia on a like an international tournament. I think it might have been a four team tournament. I think we played Australia and I forget the other countries that we played now. But yeah, I mean, I didn't even know what CP football was. You know, I had to do a lot of work before I went on the way that the game is adapted for those teams. And when I got there, the athleticism, the professionalism, the attitude towards, you know, they're not professional athletes. Obviously, they're having to balance, you know, work and life with, you know, training and trying to be the best athlete they can. It just blew me away, really, the you know, the level that those athletes were pushing themselves to. And yeah, like I say, just a great group of lads as well. You know, I really learned a lot from working with them. And camp football, you know, tournament football. Obviously, I had other tastes of that, but it's a different way of working as an analyst as well, just in terms of the workload and the pressure.
Yeah, I guess you've got to work a lot more urgently, but maybe we'll part that question because I've already alluded it to it in my introduction. We've got quite a big tournament that you were involved in. I really want to drill down on that. But once you'd finished your degree, I think I'm right in saying that you did some teaching, but ultimately you wanted to get into football, so it was trying to get interviews everywhere you possibly could.
Yeah, so I mean, I think this will resonate with a lot of people who've ended up working in the game. That sometimes you have to start part time, or you know, in the England case for me, you know, when there wasn't a camp or a tournament, basically there wasn't any work. So, you know, I did get involved a little bit with you know, pre-camp planning and post-camp, you know, debriefs and stuff. But sometimes you had a couple of weeks where there wasn't any work with England. So I would end up doing some teaching. I just taught on like national diplomas and BTECs in sport, as they were at the time. And that was fine. You know, I learned a lot about managing conflict in the classroom. I learned a lot about planning, you know, planning lessons or sessions, trying to make classroom environments engaging, you know, and obviously that helped me in the analysis stuff later when you're working with athletes. You know, showing them information, you know, how much is too much, how much is too little. So that teaching experience was really valuable, but I knew that really, you know, I wanted to work in the professional side of the game rather than school or college level.
Yeah, you talked about kind of when you're trying to get work experience and reaching out to people. We mentioned Michael Edwards, Mike Dickinson, etc. It's one bit of advice that I give to young people, no matter what industry you're trying to get into, is you got to be a bit cheeky. If you don't ask, you don't get. And I do always try to. You know, when we get young people contact us at B5, where it's an aspiring lawyer, someone wants to get involved in sport, etc., try and give them some time. And I think that is really important. We've all been there. And I guess that was what it was like for you. I mean, I wouldn't say you mail bombed every single EFL and Premier League club, but it might not be too far off at that stage.
Yeah, and honestly, Matt, that's something I'm really passionate about, actually, is you know, paying it forward. You know, I know there's a lot of cliches around that, but I probably get at least one WhatsApp message a week, somebody who's either out of work that has sort of already made it, if you like. You know, they've been sacked or they've, you know, for whatever reason, been let go by a club. And then people who are trying to break in. Like I said, I think maybe one WhatsApp message, one LinkedIn message a week. And it is difficult to reply to all of them at times, but you know, I always remember people that replied to me and you know, took a chance on me. And I know that can sound a little bit cheesy, really, but especially in the industry of analysis, there's not really a body that looks after analysts, tactical analysts, data scientists, data analysts. I think it's behind sports science in that case. There's a new body just been set up, Association for Professional Football Analysts that Ollie Gage has just set up. If people want to Google that, I think they're doing some really great things already. The FCA, which is I hope I'm saying this right, but it's kind of like a sister branch of the LMA, has just been set up to look after the support staff in the game, including analysts. But it's still early days, really, and I think analysts, in whatever exact role they're in, there isn't anybody who takes care of them and sort of fights for better pay, better working conditions, help with contracts, that side of things. So anytime anyone messages me, I always try and help out and remember the time when it was me who was asking.
And you mentioned pay. I'm not going to delve into the details of, you know, whether or not analysts are underpaid, etc. But they work bloody long hours. As I said, there are so many thankless tasks in analysis. And actually, just anecdotally, I gave a presentation at a Premier League club the other day. And the room that I was given to do the presentation in was the analyst room. And these two young analysts must have been in their early 20s, were sat there clipping the whole time I was presenting. It was quite nice, to be fair. They listened to my presentation over and over again. They were testing what jokes I was making. But seeing how hard they were working, and then I don't know what they get paid, but I know that analysts probably don't get as much for their level of expertise and the amount of hours that they put in, particularly in an industry where players are so well paid. Now, of course, players are well paid because they are the talent which creates the industry, which makes all the money. I'm hesitant to put that to you because particularly as you're out of the industry as well. So maybe I should move back to your story on that one. I just kind of wanted to make...
I think it's an important thing to recognise, Matt. And like I say, I think the analysis industry has come a long way since I was working directly in it. But, you know, I still speak to people and, you know, I know what people are paid in the industry roughly. And there's been a couple of surveys in the last few years that, you know, people have sent out as part of their, you know, PhDs and stuff. And I think there's definitely a feeling or an even evidence that analysts are still, you know, certainly not paid the most inside clubs anyway. And whether they should or not, I don't know. That's a different debate. But I definitely think that the professionalization of the industry and of the profession can only help. So just like I said, in sports science area, you know, you've got bodies like BASES and you've got accreditation, official accreditation that, you know, I think that leads to a more professional environment and therefore better pay and working conditions. And I think for analysis roles in particular, whether it be in data or on the tactical side, I think there's still some way to go on that, I would say.
And you mentioned the LMA as an organisation. Their organisation does a hell of a lot for their members. And one of the things that they will do will be holistic care, mental health care, etc. And then just to bring it back to me, but that those presentations I was giving to staff that the analysts were present in, we were talking about smartphone use, social media. And one of the big things I talk a lot about now is screen time, how it's massively impacting our mental health, it's impacting our sleep, etc. That's an analyst's job, screen time. if they're doing 10 hours a day, they're doing a good job. In fact, that's probably a slow day for them, probably doing 12 or 13 or 14. So there is a kind of, it's really important that there is a bit of a mental health outlook for these young men and women. And I guess perhaps that is an organisation that Ollie and others are working on. That will be an important role for them, I would have thought.
Yeah, I think so. I think building a community as well where you can share ideas with other analysts, share, you know, the good things about the job and also share the challenges. You know, I certainly don't want this to be like a, you know, poor old analyst type thing. It's an amazing profession to be a part of, creates so many opportunities for you. You know, you're working in professional football at the end of the day. That's a dream for so many people. But at the same time, hopefully these new bodies that are being created can help. Hopefully just awareness of mental health and the well-being of staff in a club, you know, whether it be coaches or support staff, I think is being spoken about more now, just like it should be with players as well. And I think like I say, the awareness of it really just, you know, analysts knowing that they can speak to other analysts to share problems that they might have or stresses they might have. I think that's a big part of it. And hopefully organizations like the one that I work for now are also making the job slightly easier in terms of the mundane tasks. So I think we'll probably talk later about what's next for the industry and of analysis and analytics. I think technology is obviously automating a lot of the processes. So the mundane stuff, you know, downloading video, downloading data, moving it around between different tools, you know, that stuff that, you know, is no fun really. You know, most people want to be watching training. They want to be, talking to players, presenting or showing things to players to help them improve. No one wants to be doing the mundane downloading tasks. And I think they're the ones that really grind people down, I think, in support roles at clubs.
So you talked about living, let's go the positive. You talked about living the dream, working in professional football. I'll take you to 2010. In fact, 2 years back from that, 2008, Sheikh Mansour invests and buys Manchester City. And it's interesting to look back only 2 years after his takeover. It's a, you know, it's not a revolution that happens overnight. This stuff happens over time. So you get a job at Manchester City, not at their training facilities that they've got now, which are totally space age, but at Platt Lane at the academy, which I visited a number of times, and it's not like what they've got now. I guess it would be fair to say we have bad moments in our life, we have good moments. That would have been one of your good, one of your lucky moments, I guess, that you happened to arrive at Platt Lane when that revolution was happening.
Yeah, it was. I mean, that was you know, obviously an amazing time, an amazing opportunity. I think going into academy football at that time, even outside of the Man City story, was interesting because the EPPP initiative had just sort of launched, if you like. So I think all the academies got a lot of investment, and there were a lot of changes for support staff at the academies, and you know, the requirements and the standards of what clubs had to provide if they wanted to be Category 1 helped, I think, in analysis. So I think at City at the time, it was probably, I might be wrong in saying this, but I feel like it was maybe only City and Chelsea who had analysts at like under 12 to under 16 level at the time. And with EPPP, it like really exploded, and then all the academies had that, and it's completely normal now. And obviously it's a different level of analysis. You know, you're trying to create fun, educational, best practice type stuff rather than going into like big detail with data and stuff. But yeah, amazing time to be there, you know, building out that department with City. I was part of the department to begin with. I eventually ended up, you know, leading and guiding that department. And like you say, you know, just a lot of new staff came in, some of them from different countries as well, bringing a different approach. You know, and being at Platt Lane really was really nice because it was like a close-knit family feel to it. I think moving to the bigger training ground was a real challenge to, you know, keep that family feel and that close-knit feel amongst the players and staff. But I think overall it was achieved. And being part of the club at that time, you know, that rapid rate of growth was just a really big learning experience, but also really, really enjoyable.
And you mentioned Chelsea and Man City together. It's an interesting one because I think at the time when you joined City, Chelsea would have been ahead of City in terms of their academy, the players that they were producing, etc. And I say this as someone that works for both of those clubs and have huge respect for both of them. But I think the feeling probably is that the amount of time and effort and investment at City's academy means that they're probably considered the strongest of all of the academies now.
Yeah, I think it's really, obviously you see like the academy productivity ratings that come out. There's a lot of talk about which academy is doing it best, etc. I think it completely depends on, you know, what does the club constitute as being success. And some academies, you know, are producing amazing players, but the pathway to the first team might not be there. So those players are being sold or loaned out. It becomes more of a business, if you like a revenue generator. So I think that part of the game is really interesting that people are noticing now. I don't really know how you distinguish which are the best academies, but, you know, in terms of having being part of like building a playing style where all the teams at the academy from top to bottom played the same way, and then that went into the first team, being part of putting together like a game model document that was shared with all the coaches, putting together a kind of like a best practice library of how we want to coach, what our identity is as an academy. Obviously, I didn't lead that, but to be part of it and helping the leaders at City at the time in doing that was, again, just, you know, cool experience. And it's something, the lessons that I took from being part of City at that stage and then later it becoming the CFG type of thing, you know, I still take those lessons and use them now when I talk to clubs in my current role.
And having been within those kind of environments, with that city, within that city environment, you look at someone like Phil Foden. There's a temptation to say, look, he's a Stockport boy from a family of Man City supporters. He would still be in the same position now if there wasn't a great academy. But that may well be wrong, because you, what you described there is, you know, there's a DNA. I don't know whether that's the right phrase for it, but you know, a way of doing things at Manchester City, which he was schooled as part of. And I think as football fans, sometimes we probably underestimate the influence that someone like Phil, notwithstanding he's a huge natural talent, but the influence he would have had of having been schooled through that academy process.
Yeah, I think what's cool about the story of Phil and players that were that type of age was that I think that was the first age group that was put into like private school as well at the time. So there was a private school not far from the academy, St. Bede's, and the players, I think they were the first group. They went to St. Bede's in the morning to do normal school, and then in the afternoon they came to the academy and trained every day. So I think that kind of thing like now is quite normal, I think, in the academy system. But at the time that was quite revolutionary. I don't think there were many clubs that were doing that. So it's really interesting to look at Phil's story in terms of that, you know, that amount of contact time that he got and being part of that environment, you know, probably people would say that was part of his development. But then there's the other part as well with players like Phil that, you know, look, I'm into analysis and like helping players and building game methodologies and stuff like that. But sometimes with talents like Phil, I think people just need to get out of his way almost, you know, and he, you know, more than likely would have made it anyway, you know. And a really nice lad and a really nice family as well. So I think sometimes we can overthink these things, overcomplicate them, but people like Phil might have probably would have just made it anyway, you know, just a special talent.
We're talking about special talents. I think, am I right in saying this was still during your time at Man City? You had a free summer in 2014, and someone made the call, I couldn't tell us who, invited you to come and do one of those camps. But one of those camps was a huge one. It was to go with the Ghanaian national team to the World Cup in 2014. And just to add a bit of context, in 2010, Ghana had reached the quarterfinals in South Africa, where, I'll put it delicately, Luis Suarez robbed them of the opportunity of being the first African nation to make it to a semi-final. The famous handball sent off, Azamoujian missed the penalty. Although he scored in the penalty shootout, they lost on penalty. So that was a huge, huge moment for Ghana. And, you know, I think it was Pele that said, by 2000, an African nation would have won the World Cup, and they hadn't. But there's no doubt that well, as we look at African nations now, they are starting to compete. So this is a time when African nations are doing things like the European nations, I guess, is probably the way of saying it, that they are really giving it a go and doing it professionally. So you get brought in to be part of the analysis team with Ghana in the World Cup. So I don't know what's my question. It's just an opening. Tell us all about that.
Yeah, I get asked about it a lot, and people sometimes see it on the CV and think, how did that happen and stuff. The way that it happened, I think everyone's probably aware of the Right to Dream Academy. And the Right to Dream Academy at the time were bringing players over for short training stints at different clubs. So Man City was one of those clubs. I think they also took boys to United and Liverpool, I think, at the time. But through them bringing players to City, I got to know a couple of the staff at Right to Dream pretty well, including Tom, who obviously leads the group now. And you know, so I was aware of the Right to Dream Academy. I was aware of a little bit about Ghanaian football, the fact that a couple of graduates had gone from Right to Dream through to the Ghanaian first team, etc. So eventually, one way or another, the head coach at the time ended up coming on a study visit to City, and I spent a bit of time with him with James Kwesi-Appiah, and you know, enjoyed talking to him. I watched a couple of games with him. He left the study group and I didn't think anything of it, and then the phone went to the club a couple of I think it was only about 6 weeks before the World Cup to ask if we could, you know, helped them with having like their first analyst. They'd never really had an analyst before. They didn't have any equipment, I don't think, either. So I think they were looking for help with that from the club. And I think a couple of the first team staff at City couldn't do it for whatever reason. So I'm not sure if I was like fourth choice or whether I was the choice. I'm not sure, but I ended up, I just said yes immediately. I remember telling my wife that I just worked all season. We weren't married at the time, but I remember coming home and saying, you know, I know we were supposed to be going on a nice like summer holiday, but now I'm going to like Brazil for this tournament via Ghana. So that went down well, something that I'm sure a lot of people working in the game can sympathize with. But yeah, an amazing experience, you know, going to the World Cup anyway. The fact that it was in Brazil, obviously, you know, home football in my mind, even more than England. Yeah. And then doing it with a country that is, you know, culturally obviously very different type of team environment was just a big experience.
Yeah, and in terms of culture, I think the majority of the lads by that stage would have been playing European football. And there's some really big names. I just kind of scribbled some of them down. So you've got, Michael Essien, what a footballer he was. You've got Asamoah Gyan 4 years after the experience in 2010. Suleiman Tari, I don't know whether he would have been at somewhere like Sunderland or maybe Inter Milan by then, I don't know. You've got the two IU brothers, Jordan and Andre. You've got Kevin Prince-Boateng as well. So, you know, these are top players. But was there the top European lads and then all the lads that were still playing back home in Africa? I mean, what was the kind of dynamic in that environment?
Yeah, I get asked about that experience a lot, Matt, and I always kind of like split it into two different parts. The first part is that I learned a lot tactically about the game, you know, being, you know, watching the best teams in the world, preparing to play the best teams in the world. Like we had Germany and Portugal in our group at the time, plus the USA, I've got it mentioned with being in the States. So I learned a lot tactically about the game, just, you know, preparing in that way. But the biggest lessons I had was on like team environment. So you had a real split in the group. And I don't mean a split as in the boys didn't get on. I just mean, you know, the situations that they were in. So you had the big names that you just mentioned playing at the biggest clubs in the world, in Europe. And some of them have been there a long time, you know. So, you know, they would be speaking English around the dinner table or, you know, German. There was a couple of the boys played in Germany. Maybe they were German, but they had Ghanaian heritage, etc. And in terms of the food that was served, there was always a European option and there was always a traditional Ghanaian option. And then obviously around the table, you also had the boys who were either still in Africa or they'd only recently left Africa for clubs elsewhere. So there was this really interesting dynamic in the group that I found really fascinating. The way that was handled by the staff, I also found really interesting. Some of it I really agreed with, other parts of it I didn't agree with. But, you know, again, high pressure environment, dealing with those differences within the group. I think it was reported openly at the time, so I can talk about it, that there were some disciplinary issues in the group as well. So being on the inside of that, obviously a lot of people don't know about that stuff because they're not in the camp, but, you know, seeing that firsthand and the interactions between staff and players was fascinating, really. And something that, you know, I'm trying to develop as a leader now myself. And there's certainly some lessons that I take from that when I look back on it.
Did you get a kind of instinct of the amount of pressure that comes from a World Cup? You know, these lads, proud Ghanaians, so some of them might be from the diaspora, Ghanaian diaspora, but, you know, these are lads who have gone, left Ghana, made their fortune, become superstars. 4 years after a really successful World Cup, you know, Ghana expects. Did you get the instinct of these young lads? And this is the thing, whenever you work with football players, we see these boys up on the TV, they look like grown men, and they are grown men, but they're so bloody young when you get up close and personal with them. Did you get an instinct of the pressure that they were under?
Yeah, definitely. I didn't understand fully, you know, how big the game is in Ghana until until I was part of the group. You know, you obviously do your research online and stuff, but it was only when you spend time with the staff and like you learn about the send off that they got from Ghana, because I actually met them in Europe. We did the pre-tournament camp in Holland, and then we moved to the States and then to Brazil. So before the tournament, I actually didn't go to Ghana. So I didn't see any of the, you know, the send off that they got, the kind of hysteria, because people genuinely felt like this was a chance for an African nation to go and win the whole thing. I think even though we had the group of death, it was named at the time. So there was definitely pressure on them, without doubt. And we went to a reception dinner in the US at the Ghanaian embassy. And it felt like there were thousands of Ghanaians there who were living in the States that had come to this reception dinner. So even on a small scale, I was like, wow, if this is what it's like in the States with just Ghanaians who are now living in the States, and that's the send-off that we get from the pre-tournament camp, you know, I could only imagine what it would be like in Ghana itself. So hugely passionate country for the sport. I think it was seen as being like a bit of a golden generation, a little bit like the England thing, which struggled to deliver. And yeah, you know, on the pitch, the tournament was massively unsuccessful. I mean, we definitely didn't perform as we were expected to, you know, despite having the group of death. And I think, you know, it was a disappointment, really. I think the guys, when they left the camp and left the tournament, I think there was definitely a feeling that, you know, they hadn't really given the best impression of themselves as a team. And I think the coaching staff changed after that tournament. So I was never actually with the group again, because I think it was seen as being a failure, even though it was the group of death.
And it's an interesting one, because you look at the results. They lost 2-1 in the first game against USA, and that would have been devastating, because that's the game that they would have thought, if we can win this, we might get through the group. But World Cups are so unforgiving, because once they've lost that, they then got the Boateng derby, which was Kevin Prince playing against his brother Jerome, and it's a 2-2 draw against Germany. And then to lose 2-1 to Ronaldo's Portugal, and that's probably Ronaldo at the absolute top of his game at that point. I think Ronaldo scored in that game, and that's what put them out in the tournament. There's a lot of talk about input versus output. And from a mental health perspective, I think it's important. You know, when I go and do something, I can look after the input, I can work hard on it, I can do my best at it, but sometimes the outputs are, in the football context, the other team were just better than us. And the fact is, if you're playing against Germany and Portugal, a 2-1 draw and a 2-1 defeat, your inputs might not have been that bad. And I guess that's the cold-hearted analysis element of it. But the fact is, you can't have a cold-hearted analysis when you've got, I don't know how many millions of people there are in Ghana, probably about 40, 50, 60. They'll be broken-hearted as a result of it.
Yeah, I think, Matt, you're absolutely right on that US game. I mean, potentially we built the US game up too much, maybe, even in the camp. You know, it was like, as a staff, I don't know if it actually fed through to the players or not, but as a staff, we were very, you know, intent on, we've got to get a result out of this game. And it's funny, because from like the work point of view, you know, we did a lot of work, preparation work on starting the game well, making sure we went out there and, you know, kept it tight in the first however many minutes. You know, we conceded really early in the game. And then we also did a lot of work on set pieces and conceded from a set piece with like 10 minutes to go and ended up losing the game. So, you know, despite all the work that you put in as a staff and as a group of players and the best intentions, you know, you lose that game. And then possibly it took the pressure off a little bit with the Germany game, because we actually played pretty well in the Germany game. Completely different game plan that was decided upon by the coaching staff, but, you know, probably gave a better account of ourselves. Maybe it was because there's no pressure. Probably should have won the game at the end, actually. But I think there was a big chance with, I think it was Jordan Ayew, I think he we didn't quite make the most of that opportunity on the counter-attack. And then really, you know, you're going into the Portugal game. I think the odds are stacked against you anyway. I think you're looking at mathematical type situations, and we lost that game too, but no great shame in that, because they had a really good side at the time, and, you know, peak Ronaldo. So In terms of dealing with pressure as staff and as players, definitely you could feel it. Obviously, my experience before that was kind of academy and under 23 football, which at a big club like City, there's still pressure. It's still very much a high performance environment, but different type of pressure when you're at a World Cup for sure.
Yeah, well, we talk to young boys a lot about the pressure of 3 points. I mean, in terms of the mental health exertion on you, it's absolutely huge. And then you add to that the hopes of a nation, everything else. It is extraordinary, absolutely extraordinary. So talking about pressure, your next role was, when you left Manchester City, to go back to the club that you grew up as a little boy supporting. And you spent three or four years at Liverpool. And I think I'm right in saying that that kind of overlaps with your role at Huddle as well. So just kind of talk to us a little bit about how all that worked.
Yeah, I think I got back from the World Cup and, you know, me and you have spoken about the mental side of things and work-life balance a few times, Matt. And I think I got back from the World Cup and I sort of went on holiday and I came back and I had to go straight into pre-season with City. I think I was actually late getting to pre-season, I think. I think I got a bit of banter from the lads for turning up late to pre-season. People were saying I was a big timer because I'd been to a tournament and stuff. But I remember thinking, what am I going to do next? You know, probably prematurely looking back on it because 5 years isn't a long time in football, but... you know, I remember thinking, what am I going to do next? You know, I'm already at one of the biggest clubs at academy level. I've got every resource and tool for an analysis that I could possibly want. And I'm probably rightly or wrongly, I was, you know, not bored. Bored sounds really ungrateful, but I was just thinking, you know, what am I going to do next? You know, where do I go from here? And that was when I did one more season there and then the Huddle opportunity came up. And I kind of thought with Huddle, well, maybe a change is as good as a rest almost. Maybe I can go and learn about what other clubs are doing because, you know, they all buy Huddle products. So I would be able to visit these clubs, you know, I'd be able to go and visit Chelsea and, you know, they would most likely, you know, tell me what they're doing, which they would never do while I'm at City, obviously. And also I would learn from other sports. I've always been really interested in the NFL and American sports. So that was my thinking on the Huddle side. So people thought I was crazy at the time leaving the City thing. Maybe the Huddle opportunity came earlier than maybe I thought it would. But I remember just thinking, even if I only do it a year, I'll learn a lot and then maybe I can go back to another club. You know, and 7 years later, I'm still here. But at the same time, the Liverpool guys heard that I'd left City. I was really close to a couple of them through different things. Obviously, it was right on my doorstep. And they asked if I could kind of mix my two roles. So I was kind of like half and half on both jobs as like a academy's kind of regional scouting manager, coordinator, and then also doing the Huddle piece as well. So not easy to balance out, but I guess I got my thing where I got a lot of learning on the Huddle side, and then I had my thing where I was still around the grass and connected to everyday football more directly by being with Liverpool. So, you know, that was how it came about.
And well, look, you talk about work-life balance. You're talking to me from Lincoln, Nebraska. I know you didn't start. Obviously, you didn't start in the States because you were working with Liverpool at the same time. But the move came. You've also referenced, forgive me for kind of leaping on the kind of personal things you talked about. You referenced your then girlfriend, now wife. It's a big thing to move abroad. It's a big thing to move to the States. I mean, how did it go down with your other half, and how have you coped as a family?
It's been an amazing experience. I think I did 4.5 years in Europe with Huddle, and we did some like really key projects in some developing countries to do like national type projects where, you know, all the analysts for the first time got access to like a real analysis workflow. You know, the league or the federation paid for it. And I just thought I'd be in that role and living in Liverpool, you know, forever. You know, I never really planned to go abroad or anything. The job was going well. like I said, I was working on these cool projects, and at home I felt like I had, you know, a good work-life balance. We just bought a house and everything. And then the game in the States, and the amount of, you know, money that's coming into the game here at the moment, there was a feeling that they really wanted to, Huddle really wanted to attack the market over here. And I think they saw some of the projects that we'd done in Europe and thought we could maybe transfer it to the same approach to the States. So I remember bringing it up with Pam. I'd actually been here to the office on like a all staff meeting where they bring everybody over. Did a week at the office here in the States, went back and said, you know, there might be an opportunity for me to move over. You know, I've been asked if we'd be interested in doing that. And I think it took us a couple of weeks. I think we actually made the decision in the pub after a bottle of wine. It was like, look, we need to make a decision. We'd made a pros and cons list. Pam, my wife, is a very pros and cons list person. And yeah, we ended up just saying, yeah, let's just do it. You know, if we don't do it, might always look back on it and think, what if, you know, all the things in the list to stay were like family, obviously, and friends that you will miss. And then just stuff that you owned. You know, we owned a nice car. We were really lucky that we had a nice car. We were really lucky that we had a nice house. But, you know, those things can be sold, or, you know, you can always get them back again. We were like, let's try something new. And yeah, we've been here for a few years now and really enjoying it.
Yeah, they're things. And my colleague Fraser always talks about, I think, moments over money. I think that's the way of looking at it. You know, it's these little moments that you'll get, and that's why we live life, because we'll look back at the end of our days and say, you know, did I take a few chances? Did I enjoy those moments? Yes, 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 and yes. And that's got to be the way for it. And actually, it reminds me, there was one thing I wanted to ask you about, and forgive me, I know that people ask you about the Ghana experience all the time, but there's something you and I have spoken about before that I wanted to reference. Is I'm not a religious man at all. I have no religion. As John Lennon said, but I'm fascinated by the way that the West African teams, and obviously the West African culture, goes, which is very influenced by strong feelings of religion. Because we talk about mental health, we talk about gratitude, and I think the strength that they get in their faith is absolutely huge. And I know that there's something you and I have spoken about before that you really experienced with them as someone. And forgive me for painting this picture. You and I are probably two people that the sun is not necessarily our friend. So you would have stood out like a sore thumb in that. You're a lad from Merseyside who turns up amongst all these West African people with a huge faith that they have. And they would have had their little kind of ceremonies. I don't know whether that's the right word, but where they give gratitude, where they do their little dances. And I've just got this image in your head of seeing you in the midst of that. But I also know you are someone that throws yourself into this kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I don't know if you're going to ask a question then, or whether you were just waiting for my reaction. So
I was looking at your face when I was saying it.
Yeah, I mean, for example, after every flight that you would take, at a tournament in Brazil, there's a lot of flying. I lost count of how many flights that we did to like different locations to play games and stuff. After every flight on the tarmac, everybody would stand in a circle, hold hands, and one of the players would basically say a prayer of some sorts and give thanks for, you know, safe arrival, and, you know, ask for blessings for the forthcoming, you know, training week or for the game. And before and after every training session, there would also be some sort of prayer. And sometimes like a local song. I think everyone's probably seen that when the team arrive at the stadium before a game, they basically sing some sort of song asking for goodwill and good fortune. You know, and it's a cool spectacle when people see it on TV, but there's actually a real meaning behind it, and the group feel really strongly about doing that. And I too am not really anybody of faith really or great spirituality, but definitely have strong values around you know, being grateful for what I have and the journey that I've been on, and I take a lot from that Ghanaian experience, and I take a lot now from being in the States, you know, surrounded by different cultures and different faiths. And the company I work for now does a lot of work on diversity and inclusion, etc. So the whole thing is just like a lesson, really, I guess, like life lesson. And just trying to stay open-minded, really. You know, like, I mean, again, it sounds cheesy, but I just feel like life is an education. The opportunities that sport in general gives to people professionally and personally to learn and to grow is amazing, really. And yeah, I just hope that I'm part of it for a lot longer, really, and just continue to be grateful for what I have and what's to come.
Embrace the positivity of your experiences.
Yeah. I mean, I've done a lot of reading, actually. On there's an author called Ryan Holiday. I'm sure a lot of people have read a lot of his stuff. And somebody recommended that I read his books on kind of Stoic philosophy and how that translates to professional and personal life. And I remember thinking, that's not for me. You know, I don't want to Stoic philosophy. As soon as I read his first book, I was absolutely hooked. And I actually carry something around in my wallet now that is like a little a statement from his book, if you like. And it's just there every now and again to remind me that if I get stressed or, you know, things are busy or maybe I'm on the road and I'm missing family. Yes, you know, those are all challenges in life, but, you know, also be grateful for the fact that a lot of things in your life you can control and can't control, and know the difference between the two. You know, I think that, you know, have the wisdom to know the difference between those two things. And I think that has really helped me to be grateful, to embrace the challenges that you face, and also the, you know, to embrace the good moments as well. Because, you know, there were definitely times at City where I had a tough time just dealing with the environment and the expectations. Same thing in, you know, in the Ghana camp. But I mean, what an experience to have, you know. And whatever happens, like I say, in life going forward, I mean, it's cool stuff to tell the grandkids and all that type of stuff.
Absolutely. That's really nice to hear you tell that story about your outlook and your learning, and then talk Stoicism learning. And then actually then relates back to Christian teachings and the serenity prayer is effectively what that is. It's just all geared towards, you know, good positivity and good mental health, which, yeah, absolutely. Which then leads us to the final thing I wanted to ask you is that, what's the future? I'm going to ask that as the open question. So what is the future? What's the future of John McGuigan? What's the future of Hurdle? What's the future for analysis? Answer that if you can.
Yeah, I think I'll start with rather than talking about Hurdle specifically, I think I'll talk about like the industry in general. I think that, like I said before, I hope the conditions are improving for all the people who are working in the support area. Our products are basically used by coaches and by the support staff at these clubs and also the players. So I hope that the work that we do and the industry does just continues to help those personas. Our kind of mission at the company is to help teams and athletes make every moment count. So whether that be helping them win more games or helping a high school or a college kid get a scholarship at a pro team or an academy kid get a contract at the first team, etc. You know, I hope that what we build and what we provide just helps to continue doing that. I think in terms of, you know, how that will be done, I think automation, I've mentioned already, you know, the technology is just going to keep getting smarter. It's going to automate a lot of the processes that have to happen for video and data analytics to take place. And of course, the data is just going to get bigger. And with that comes a need for people working in this space to be able to interpret that data, put context on it, and make it understandable for the audience. So whether it be a report going to a coach or a presentation going to a player, the it's kind of like the mix of the science and the art is the way that I describe it. So, you know, the professionals involved in that process are just going to have to get even better at translating all of this information, you know, knowing how much is too much and knowing how much is too little, and also knowing what's actually important. You know, what information that we can provide as professionals will actually impact the next training session, the next game plan, or the player's development. You know, if you're not going to see this information affect behavior on the grass, then why are we collecting the information and you know, why are we delivering it to people, you know, in the process? So I guess that's the industry, if that yeah, makes sense, probably a little broad. I think for me personally, that's probably a good question. I would like possibly to maybe transfer all of the lessons that I've learned from the game and now on the commercial side, maybe back to the game again a little more directly. I've got an amazing job here. The place that I work is, you know, incredible for development. But a big part of my role is to act as a consultant for our biggest clients. So I will go on the road and visit, you know, the biggest MLS teams or the biggest NCAA teams, league offices, federations and stuff. And, you know, I'll go in there and meet with these amazing organizations, explain, you know, how they can maybe make better use of what we can offer and explain what best practices and what lessons maybe they could take from the other organizations that we work with. But I find that quite frustrating sometimes because I'll go in and do that on one day and then I have to come away and then obviously it's out of my control what they actually decide to do. So I think long term, maybe I would like to, you know, transfer everything I've learned from the game and now business back to the game a little bit more directly, whether that be with a federation or a league office or maybe working back with a club. But overall, Matt, I think I'm just, you know, still enjoying the journey that I'm on and I'm developing, you know, as a leader. I'm back at school doing a master's now, which is difficult to manage sometimes, but, you know, the gift of learning is something that I'm really enjoying again. That's in like it's like a sports director's, the sports directorship master's with UCF BGIS that you mentioned earlier. And I'm developing as a leader all the time. So, you know, regardless of who actually employs me, I would just like to be the best leader that I can be and you know, the best professional I can be and hopefully also still be the best husband that can be at home as well and make sure that I don't lose that work-life balance that I've mentioned over and over.
Well, as someone that still has nightmares about my university exams and turn that unprepared, you have my huge admiration that you're going back to school, mate. So well done for that.
Cheers.
Well, great. Look, John, thank you so much for your time. It's the kind of the gratitude and positivity that you have really, really shines out. And I hope every now and then you reflect on how well you've done to be sat where you are now. And thank you for telling your story to us.
Yeah, no problem, Matt. And I've got to say, just to finish, you know, I feel really humbled to be asked to be on this. Obviously, we've known each other for a long time, but big fan of the pod. I mean, I listened to Sean's episode last week. You know, the way that he handled adversity and the journey that he's been on. You know, even Fraser and Lee, obviously working with yourself, you know, to be in that company, I guess, on this. You know, I'm not sure I'm quite as interesting as those people, but and certainly haven't had some of the difficulties that they've faced. But like I say, just enjoyed it and humbled to be asked and glad we could do it.
That's very, very kind, John. Really means a lot to us as well, so thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Football Journeys. You can follow us on social media on both Twitter and Instagram at JourneysPod. This is Football Journeys.